From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the autistic woman neurologist Oliver Sacks describes as one of the most remarkable autistic people of all. In spite of her autism, Temple Grandin is a successful designer of humane restraining equipment for cattle and hogs. She's written a memoir called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. Also today, we remember French film director Louis Malle with an excerpt of our 1988 interview. He died last week at the age of 63. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Women on Ice, Feminist Responses to the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan Spectacle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Three white Pittsburgh police officers have been charged in the death of a black businessman who suffocated while in police custody last month after being pulled over in a traffic stop. Two of the officers are charged with third-degree homicide, the third with manslaughter. Two other officers were not charged. One is set to testify for the prosecution. The victim, Johnny Gamage, was the cousin of Pittsburgh Steelers football player Ray Seals. Two autopsies found that he suffocated because of pressure on his chest and neck. Gamage's mother says all five officers allegedly involved should serve time. House Speaker Newt Gingrich announced today he will not run for president next year. Gingrich said he made a final decision after consulting with his wife and children over the Thanksgiving holiday. He said he's not ready to endorse a candidate in the GOP race. The Republican frontrunner, Senator Bob Dole, has picked up the endorsement of one of the nation's most prominent governors. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson has put his support behind fellow Republican Dole, saying he and the Kansas senator have worked together on issues like welfare reform, agriculture, and states' rights. Thompson is the top official of several national organizations, including the National Governors Association. Thompson says the timing is right to get involved in the presidential race.
If we're going to win in November, it's time that people like myself get off the dime and get behind a candidate, and that happens to believe that Bob Dole is the strongest candidate, and I'm going to support him enthusiastically.
Thompson claims he is not likely to be Dole's choice for vice president, but Dole refuses to rule Thompson out. Dole has now been endorsed by 16 of the nation's 31 Republican governors. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
Algeria's president has been formally sworn in for a 5-year term in a ceremony attended by 500 dignitaries amid reports of a new opening with the leading Islamic opposition group. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Islamic Salvation Front leader Youssef Boubré has reportedly offered a unilateral ceasefire in Algeria's civil war as part of an attempt to renew a dialogue with President Lamine Zerouali. Boubré was quoted in an Algerian newspaper as saying that the front's executive bureau would be meeting in the next few days and the announcement of a ceasefire could be made soon. His comments give more credence to reports of a shift within the front towards negotiations with the government following Zerouali's landslide victory in presidential elections less than 2 weeks ago. Two prominent exiled front leaders have publicly disagreed over pursuing talks with the government, and previous talks with imprisoned front leaders and government officials have collapsed. An estimated 40,000 people have been killed in Algeria since 1992, when the military regime banned the front and canceled multi-party elections that would have brought it to power. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 33.5 points in active trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton says he believes the American people will support the administration's commitment to send U.S. troops to Bosnia as part of a NATO peacekeeping force once they've heard his explanation of the mission this evening. He speaks at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The leader of the Bosnian Serbs says if NATO troops try to arrest him on war crimes charges, there will be carnage in Bosnia. Radovan Karadzic claims his army has not committed any atrocities. He also says Serbs will never accept Muslim control of Sarajevo as specified in the peace agreement. Karadzic and other Serb leaders have been indicted by an international tribunal for genocide and crimes against humanity. Panamanian authorities now believe drug traffickers are responsible for the destruction of Panamanian commuter aircraft last year. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
Panamanian officials are now convinced that the mid-air explosion that destroyed a local commuter aircraft last year, killing all 21 persons aboard, was the work of drug traffickers. Since 12 of the passengers were Jewish businessmen, Panamanian investigators had theorized that the terrorist action was carried out by an anti-Zionist group based in Lebanon. According to prosecutor Juan Tejada, two of the dead passengers were linked to money laundering operations controlled by the Cali drug cartel. They were killed to stop them from testifying to a grand jury investigating the activities of Colombian drug lords in Panama. The destruction of the aircraft and the bombing of a Jewish community center in Argentina had led Panamanian authorities to believe that the terrorist actions were related to anti-Jewish activities by pro-Palestinian groups from the Middle East. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
A judge in Salem, Oregon, today ordered the release of a man and woman who have been in prison for nearly 4 years for a murder authorities now say they didn't commit. After the two were convicted, another man came forward and said he alone killed Tajna Bennett of Portland. That man is now in prison after being convicted of murder. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Temple Grandin, is an autistic woman. Neurologist Oliver Sacks, who profiled her in his book An Anthropologist on Mars, described her as one of the most remarkable autistic people of all. In spite of her autism, she holds a Ph.D. in animal science, teaches at Colorado State University, and runs her own business. She's worked for many livestock companies, designing humane restraining systems for handling cattle and hogs. One-third of the cattle and hogs in the U.S. are handled in equipment she designed. To make her achievements even more extraordinary, she's written her second book, called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. Autism is a condition of aloneness. Most autistics shut out anything from the outside and insist on sameness and repetition in all their movements. Dr. Sacks says Grandin's story shows there are forms of autism which don't incapacitate in the expected ways. Grandin owes much of her success to her ability to think in pictures.
I think totally visually. All of my thoughts are like videotapes playing on a VCR in my head. When I design livestock handling equipment, I can test run the system in my head. It was easy for me to figure out how animals think and how animals would react because I think visually. Animals don't think in language, they think in pictures. It's very easy for me to imagine what would it be like to go through a system if you really were a cow, not a person in a cow costume, but really were a cow. And autistic senses and emotions are more like the senses of an animal. My nervous system was hypervigilant. Any little thing out of place, like a water stain on the ceiling, would set off a panic reaction. And cattle are scared of the same thing. They're scared of things like high-pitched noise, sudden clanging and banging, sudden movement, maybe even a little chain that hangs down in the chute and jiggles because it looks out of place. And things that are out of place can mean danger out in the wild.
So you think that being autistic has enabled you to understand cattle better?
I think it has because the way I think and feel is more like how animals think and feel. You know, very sensitive to any little change.
No, like most autistic people, you don't really like to be hugged or touched by other people. But you found a way of getting that comforting, secure feeling from a machine that you designed.
That's right.
You call it a squeeze machine. Some people have called it a hug machine. Would you describe what the machine does?
Well, I can get in it, and it's made with foam rubber padded sides on it, and I can apply pressure to myself. See, when I was a little kid, mm-hmm. I wanted to feel a nice feeling of being hugged, but the stimulation was too overwhelming. My overly sensitive nervous system just couldn't tolerate it. You know, I got an engulfing tidal wave of stimulation just pouring over me. And when I got into puberty, I started having horrible anxiety attacks, and I found that pressure calmed it. So I built this device I could get into that would apply pressure that would calm down my nervous system. Many autistic children seek pressure. They'll get under mattresses. They'll get under sofa cushions. And at first, I would tend to just pull away from the device. But then gradually, I got to where I could tolerate more and more, you know, being touched. And now I'm, you know, much more desensitized and can tolerate it.
So how often do you use that machine now?
Oh, I will, sometimes once a week. Now that I'm traveling on the road, I hardly ever get a chance to use it.
So how does it make you feel when you use it?
Well, it makes me feel very relaxed. I'm makes me feel gentler. I think that, you know, little babies need to feel the feeling of being held in order to, you know, develop empathy. I found that my empathy with the cattle got much deeper when I actually started touching the animals. I found when I touched the animals, you know, I could calm them down.
If somebody were to hug you now, would you feel as overwhelmed and uncomfortable and afraid as you did when you were young?
Oh, no. Now I actually like it when people hug me. You know, sensory oversensitivities can be desensitized. There are a lot of little autistic kids that pull away and they don't want to be touched. But then you gradually work on touching them. It's sort of like taming a wild animal. At first, the wild animal pulls away. But then after you work on touching it, then a stimulus that was at first overwhelming becomes something that the animal will like. And firm touch is calming, and very light touch sets off a fear reaction. Also, steady pressure is calming, and sudden jerky motion causes agitation and excitement. And the same thing's true with animals, because I've designed a lot of systems for holding animals. In fact, 1/3 of all the cattle in this country, when they go to a meat processing plant, are held in a device I designed. And I found that you have to have just the right amount of pressure. You hold the animal too tight, it hurts and he fights it. If you don't hold him tight enough, he doesn't feel held and he fights it. There's an optimal amount of pressure. Also, slow, steady pressure is calming. And if you do it too quickly, the animal will get excited.
Is the hug machine that you created for yourself based on cattle restraint devices that you had seen?
Well, yes, because when I was 18 years old, I had a constant state of anxiety all the time. It was like panic attacks. I felt like first radio interview nerves all the time for absolutely no reason. You know, I was in complete nervous system flight, you know, as if a lion was stalking around, you know, ready to get me. And I was desperate to get relief. And I watched when the cattle went in the squeeze chute to hold them for their vaccinations. Some of the animals would sort of just relax. So then I talked my aunt into letting me try it. And for about an hour afterwards, I was a lot calmer. In fact, pressure is used by a lot of therapists with autistic children. They'll roll them up in mats, they'll get them under beanbag chairs, and it helps to relax them and calm down the nervous system so it's easier to work on things like learning how to talk.
So your aunt had a cattle ranch?
Yes, she did.
So after you realized how comforting the pressure of this restraining device could be, did that lead you to want to work with animals?
Well, that's one of the things that got me interested, because I started going out to the feed yards and watching how the cattle reacted. And then this was about 20 years ago, and so I wanted to learn more about how the cattle reacted to things. So I got down into the chutes with my camera and took pictures through the chutes to get a cow's eye view. In fact, that was going to be the original title for my book, but somebody in the marketing department didn't like it very much. And got down there and looked through the chutes, and I began to see the sort of things that would bother the cattle: a shadow, a little thread out of place, any little thing, a coat or hat hanging on the fence, and see the things that would make them balk.
Well, you've really devoted your life to creating more humane conditions for animals and more humane, pain-free ways of slaughtering them. Do you feel like you empathize with cattle?
Well, I know how cattle feel, and a lot of people, you know, when they think about the slaughter plan, all they can think about is, well, the cattle have got to know they're being slaughtered. Well, the things that scare the cattle are not the same things that we worry about. There's several slaughter plants in Colorado. I go, you know, visit them fairly often, and at one of them, the cattle don't like a little chain that's sometimes hanging down in the chute. They'll watch that little chain. I was at the plant one day and a train went rushing by, and the cattle were much more scared of the train than they were of going into the slaughter plant. You've got to have proper lighting. They won't go in if they can't see high-pitched noise. Sometimes just changing the plumbing on the hydraulic system to get rid of high-pitched noise will make the cattle go in much easier. It's easy for me to figure out how the cattle think, because they think the way I do. In fact, the title of my book finally got made to be Thinking in Pictures. And that's the way animals think. They think in pictures.
Tell us about one of the designs you came up with for a more humane slaughterhouse.
Well, I've done a lot of work on putting in curved chute systems, and one of the reasons this works is because the cattle can't see people up ahead. They just sort of go round and round and round like the Guggenheim Museum. And then I designed a device called a center track restrainer system, and it replaced older type conveyor systems and holds the cattle in a more comfortable manner, and they just follow through. They just keep following the animal in front of them, and they just go in there and they're shot and they don't know what's happened. Also want to emphasize the importance of good management. You can have very good equipment in a slaughter plant, but you got to have management to go along with it. The slaughter plant manager has got to control the behavior of his employees.
When you're in a slaughterhouse, is the smell of blood and the sight of the cattle lining up on their way to slaughter, is that upsetting to you?
Well, if things are going right and they're just walking in calmly, it's not upsetting. You know, people forget nature's very harsh. I mean, when a lion rips apart an animal and just dines on it while the animal's still alive, that's not very nice for the animal. And, you know, if I was an animal, I think I'd rather go to a decent slaughter plant than have a lion dine on me while I'm still alive.
You seem to really understand cattle and to be able to know what's going to disturb them and upset them. Do you feel you have the same insights about other people?
Well, you know, it's easy to figure out cattle because I think visually, and my nervous system reacts the way cattle do. But there are a lot of, you know, social things that go on. I just had to learn by, you know, rote memory. I never realized how visual my thinking was until I started talking to other people about how they thought. I mean, I used to think everybody thought in videos, and now I found out that some people think in words and just sort of vague pictures. See, all of my thinking goes from specific to general. Like, for example, my concept of what a dog is not a generalized concept, but I see a whole bunch of pictures in my mind of very specific dogs. And I've actually, you know, tested people's visual thinking by saying, access your memory on church steeples. And I deliberately picked that because it's something that's not in the room that they can see. It's not something they have at home. And most people just see sort of a vague, generalized picture. I see only specific ones, starting with very specific childhood memories and then very specific ones I saw maybe yesterday or last week. And with specific to general thinking, you know, I have to just learn social skills by example. I have to learn social skills like a child would learn in school lessons. I'm sort of like a Data on Star Trek. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my new book called Dating Data.
Right.
And when I was in high school, I mean, I just couldn't understand, why there was so much interest in things like jewelry and clothes. I mean, there was much more interesting stuff in Mr. Carlock's science lab.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written a new autobiography called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. She is autistic. She is one of the nation's leading designers of restraints for cattle. She's very successful in that field. You understand cattle so well. What do you find very mysterious about other people?
Well, my emotions are not as complex. I have a difficult time understanding how somebody can be jealous and love somebody at the same time. I definitely have emotions, but fear is one of my main emotions. And, of course, that's one of the main emotions of animals. They see a little chain or something jiggling, or they see a shadow looks out of place. They get a fear reaction. And I just don't, it just isn't part of my experience to like swoon over some guy because I think he's really cute. When I was in high school, my roommate would like practically faint on the floor when Bob, the science teacher, walked into the room. I mean, and she'd be swooning on the floor when she was watching the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan show. And I go, yeah, they're cute, but I'm not going to faint on the floor over it.
Do you understand love?
Well, I understand caring, and most of my relationships are more intellect. I have a number of friends that I think I've been able to help them out, you know, on some counseling sort of things, and to me, love is caring. In fact, my mother wrote one time that love was making something grow. I mean, that's sort of the way I look at it, but it's more of an intellectual thing. And when I see people abuse cattle, it makes me very angry. And I want to, change things.
Do you feel like you're missing out on something special by not being in love and not understanding that emotion?
I'm missing out on some things, but I also have talents that other people don't have. I don't want to give up visual thinking. In fact, Oliver Sacks asked me in his book, Anthropologist on Mars, if you could, suddenly snap your fingers and not be autistic, would you do that? And no, I wouldn't, because I don't want to give up visual thinking. Visual thinking makes me a very clear thinking gives me very, very clear thinking in scientific and technical things. To me, a lot of the highly verbal thinkers are very fuzzy thinkers and they're not logical.
My guest is Temple Grandin. She's written a new memoir called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Temple Grandin is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. Children who are autistic often engage in very repetitive, obsessive behavior, like rocking back and forth or are spinning. You did some of that when you were young.
Very definitely. And the reason why autistic children engage in these behaviors is to block out stimuli that hurt. But the problem is, if you just let the child sit in a corner and rock, he's going to end up sitting in a corner and rocking for the rest of his life. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of getting a child very early, when they're 2 and 3 and 4 years old, into a really good program. Okay, what is a good program? You need to spend a lot of hours a day just keeping that child engaged with the world. In my case, I was very lucky, and my mother really worked hard to get me a good education. At 2 and a half, I went into a speech therapy nursery school where we had a very structured day, and I was not allowed to just tune out. And then meals were structured because I'm 48 years old, and I lived at a time when you sat at the table and we were taught manners. And then my mother had a nanny that would spend 2 or 3 hours a day with me just playing games, keeping me occupied so I couldn't tune out. But then on the other hand, you've got to protect these children from certain sounds that hurt, like a smoke alarm, certain telephones, the school bell. These sounds hurt like a dentist drill going down my ear. And I was scared to go into certain rooms because I didn't know when the bell was going to go off. And the children have got to be protected from these sounds. I had a mother call me up, and she told me her child was scared to death of church. He would go into the Sunday school, but he wouldn't go into the church. And the reason for this is that one day the microphone fed back and squealed, and that hurt the child's ears. And he was afraid to go in there because he was afraid it would happen again.
When you went to school as a girl, was it a public school?
I went to a small private school. I had 2 years of really intensive treatment, and I was mainstreamed into a normal kindergarten at age 5. But it was a very old-fashioned, highly structured kindergarten. There was only 12 children in the class with an older, experienced teacher. There was no open classroom with kids running around doing all different sorts of things. Everybody did the same thing all at once.
Now, I want to get back to the idea of spinning, that kind of obsessive, or rocking, that kind of obsessive behavior. You say that it helped you and helps a lot of like autistic people block out painful stimuli.
Well, it helps you block out painful stimuli. But the problem is, if you let the child do it all day, that's all they'll do. Autism is a neurological disorder. Research done by Margaret Bowman in Boston shows very clearly that there's immature development in the limbic system of the brain and in the cerebellum, which is involved with balance and with sensory modulation.
When I see somebody spinning or rocking obsessively, to me it looks like the behavior of someone who's incredibly frustrated and unhappy. Was there any sense of frustration when you would be rocking?
Well, actually, once I got rocking, it was almost like taking a drug. I mean, I would just, I used to like to rock. I also used to like to just sit and dribble sand through my hands, and it was just like getting high on something. And I would just be completely tuned out. See, when you have senses that hurt, you have two choices. You can let the whole world come in and just blast you out, or you can sit and rock and shut everything out. And then you get addicted to rocking. It's just like taking an addictive drug. And there's some evidence in animals that there is actually an addiction. Endorphins get released, which are the brain's own natural, opioids. And you can get addicted to the behavior. But I wouldn't be here now if I'd been allowed to sit in a corner and rock for 8 hours a day.
What was the best way and what was the worst way that an adult could approach you to get you to stop rocking?
Well, the worst thing you can do is cause too much sensory stimulation. Now, there's different levels of autism. I had sensory sensitivities, but I did not have the kind of problems where seeing and hearing were actually mixing together. You did an interview a while back with Donna Williams, and she described being mono-channel. In other words, she couldn't see and hear at the same time. My problems weren't as severe. So as long as I was in a reasonably quiet room, the teacher could kind of just say, now, come on, you just pay attention. She could literally snap me out of it, where a child that's like Donna Williams, that's not going to work. In fact, Donna told me that if somebody had grabbed her chin and tried to force her to pay attention, she would just go into sensory shutdown and nothing would get through. With her, you have to take a much more gentle approach, maybe get a darkened room, and just work with singing very softly so that only one sensory channel is used very gently at a time.
Did you ever experience what she describes as that kind of sensory shutdown, the shutdown of her whole system?
No, I did not. You see, her sensory problems are more severe than mine are. Both Donna and I are both very intelligent people. I want to make it very clear this has nothing to do with mental retardation. This has to do with sensory processing. And even in my own case, I have problems with understanding complex speech sounds. I think one of the things we need to be looking at a lot more carefully in these children is, can they understand complex speech? You can pass a pure tone hearing test, and that doesn't tell you anything about your ability to understand complex speech. And I have problems with mixing up different consonant sounds. I have to figure out words by context. Last year I had a new research hearing test where they tested my ability to understand complex sounds and process complex sounds, and I mixed up things like workshop and woodchuck. Now, if I was out working with one of my meat clients, I'd know that they weren't talking about the woodchuck. If we were down in the maintenance shop, they'd be talking about the workshop. So I'm able to figure it out by context.
Temple Grandin has written a new memoir called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember French film director Louis Malle with an excerpt of our 1988 interview. He died last week at the age of 63. His films include Murmur of the Heart, La Comme Lucienne, and My Dinner with André. We're listening to an excerpt of Miles Davis's score from Malle's 1958 film, Elevator to the Gallows.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Temple Grandin. She's an autistic woman who, in spite of her autism, is a successful designer of restraining systems for livestock. Neurologist Oliver Sacks profiled her in his book, An Anthropologist on Mars. She tells her own story in her new memoir, Thinking in Pictures. When did you realize that you were different from most other people?
Well, as a little kid, I had a really odd lack of awareness that I was different. And even on my visual thinking, I mean, I was an adult before I realized that other people did not have the extensive visual thinking that I had. And I'd go out on a job where we'd be designing equipment, and I'd go, how could the engineers be so stupid? Wouldn't they know that's not going to work? Well, I just assumed everybody had visual thinking. You know, now when I've, like, carefully interviewed people about how they think, I've realized it's not stupidity that caused them to design it wrong. They simply don't have visual thinking. I mean, some engineers definitely do have it. There are non-autistic people that have visual thinking. But there's also some people out there that have very limited visual thinking.
Do you watch movies and television a lot and feel like you learn a lot from other people by watching them portrayed?
I like to watch things like, you know, the news magazine shows. I really like listening to things like, All Things Considered and Fresh Air, because I get lots of information from those things.
What's it like for you to listen to the radio and have words without pictures?
Well, I make the pictures. As the person talks, I make the pictures. And if they're talking about something where I can't make pictures, then it does not get remembered very well.
What if the conversation is about something pretty abstract, about ideas?
It depends what the idea is, because a lot of abstract ideas I convert to pictures. Like somebody asked me the other day, how do you visualize eternity, the concept of eternity? Well, I just see Star Trek and, you know, looking out the front window of the Starship Enterprise and just seeing space going out there forever and ever and ever. I think about the Hubble telescope that was built to look to the ends of the universe. Those are the sort of things that are that pictures that form my concept of eternity. Or you take a concept like a truth. Well, I think of things that were examples of truth, like reading a newspaper article about a man who returned a wallet with all the money in it.
Right. How do you live now? Do you live alone?
Yeah, I just live by myself. Basically, my work is my life. Uh-huh. And that's true for other successful autistic adults. There's some other autistic adults that, doing well in jobs. One of the best kind of job is freelance work. I do all my work freelance. I can go into a plant, get the system designed, and get out of there before I get into some hassle with the people there. There's a lady that I know who's autistic that does computer programming on industrial computers that run equipment in factories such as breweries. She goes in, she does the job, she gets out. Both of us have developed an expertise in a very specialized area. And an autistic person has to sell their work rather than themselves. I recommend to other autistic people, develop a talent and then make a portfolio of your work, because you're going to have to bypass the personnel office and show it right to the art department or the computer department.
Are people ever reluctant to work with you because you are autistic?
Well, in the beginning, they really thought I was really nerdy, and I remember one time being in an agricultural engineering meeting, and they thought I was really, you know, weird. And then I pulled out a drawing that I had done of a cattle handling facility, and the engineers went, "You drew that?" They just couldn't believe that, you know, this weird nerd could draw such a nice drawing. But as soon as they saw the drawing and they saw how nice it was, then they started having a different attitude towards me.
Do you feel that as time goes by, you're becoming less autistic?
Well, you keep learning how to get more and more normal. It's sort of like Data on Star Trek. You know, Data keeps trying to learn more about how people act. And I remember watching a Star Trek, and I wish I could remember the name of the episode, but Data was trying to date a girl. And it was a total disaster, because he told her that she was beautiful in scientific terms, like saying, you know, you have a lovely, smooth epidermis. Well, that just doesn't work.
So you identify with him?
Oh, I definitely identify with him, and I identified with Mr. Spock.
Temple Grandin is my guest, and she's written a memoir called Thinking in Pictures, and other reports from my life with autism. My understanding is that most people who are autistic like repetition, familiarity, patterns, systems. You travel a lot. You do a lot of public speaking. You do a lot of freelance work, so you're working for different people. It's amazing to me that you can do that. Are you not upset by change?
Well, you know, you've been in one Holiday Inn, you've been in them all. In fact, they're starting to standardize the beds now, and I really do like that. It seems like all the hotels now put these thick quilted spreads on, and I really like that. You know, you get so used to airports, they're not different. But it does make me nervous to do some different mode of travel. I don't travel by train very much, and trains make me nervous because I haven't been on them enough to get completely familiar with them.
Donna Williams, who is also autistic and wrote a couple of books about that, you've met her, you've spoken with her. What was it like for you to meet her? I mean, do you know a lot of other autistic people who, like you, can, you know, speak and write and function at this really high level?
I didn't actually get a chance to meet Donna. I've had some long telephone conversations with her, and those went really well because, again, that's mono channel. All she had to do was listen. In fact, I think the phone conversations are probably better than meeting her, because we could just talk, you know, normally, and she didn't have the visual distractions. I know a lot of other autistic people. I see them at the meetings, and one of the biggest problems is getting jobs. There's people out there with college degrees and with PhDs, and they don't have any job. And the ones that are successful are doing, you know, freelance work in a highly specialized, usually either a technical area or art or graphic arts. Another area that's good because of the visual thinking is things like small engine repair and automobile repair.
Judging from our conversation, it's you're a very good speaker. Is it as easy for you to write?
I can write. Because I have an associational mind, I have problems with organization. And Betsy Lerner, my editor, I'm really owe a big gratitude to her ripping her hair out on my organization, because I think associational. Like, for example, I have a thing in my book where I copied a sentence out of a magazine that described the Olympics, and it said something like, all the elements were in place, the waltzes and the little sprites jumping in the air. And that was talking about skating. Now, if I just read that whole thing, I get a picture of the skating arena. But if I stop on the word elements, then I get an association back to the periodic chart of the elements in my high school classroom. If I look at the word sprite, I get pictures of sprite cans in my refrigerator, sprite cans at the store where I buy gas. Now I go to an association of putting gas in my car at one convenience market and then putting gas in my car at another convenience store. That's how the associational mind works. And Betsy ripped her hair out on organization, and we got things organized. And if I ever do another book, I'm going to know how to prevent this problem by making a very, very good outline. And then each little part of the outline will just be two pages of the book. I mean, I'm not going to, if I ever do another book, I won't put Betsy through all of that again. Because I learned a lot about organization writing it. Because all my scientific papers, I don't have a problem, because scientific papers aren't that long. And scientific papers have a very big structure. You do an introduction, you do your methods, you do your results, and then you do your discussion, and then there's a summary.
Now, the association didn't, you know, the associative thinking didn't seem to be a problem in this interview. You stayed right on the subject all the time.
Well, because it isn't that long. You see, writing, doing the interview is more like doing a scientific paper. It isn't like doing a whole great big gigantic book.
Right.
But I just want to tell all the readers out there, I mean, I've got decent organization in my book now, and I really can thank Betsy, my editor.
Well, I'll concur. It's very well organized. It's a very good book, and I want to congratulate you on it. And thank you very, very much. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been just great to talk with you.
Temple Grandin's new memoir is called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. This is Fresh Air. The great French film director Louis Malle died last Thursday at the age of 63 of lymphoma. In the late 50s, Malle was at the forefront of the French New Wave, directors who challenged some conventions of filmmaking. At the same time, they took many American genre films more seriously than most Americans did. Malle's films include Elevator to the Gallows, also known as Frantic, The Lovers, Murmur of the Heart, Pretty Baby, Atlantic City, My Dinner with Andre, and Vanya on 42nd Street. He moved to America in 1975. In 1980, he married actress Candice Bergen. I spoke to Malle in 1988, after the release of his film Au revoir les enfants, or Goodbye Children, which he had returned to France to make. Like his earlier film, La Comme Lucienne, Au revoir les enfants is set in occupied France during World War II. The screenplay was inspired by what Malle described as the most tragic memory of his childhood. In 1944, Malle's parents sent him away from Paris to a Catholic boarding school in the countryside, where they thought he'd be protected from the war. But the school was helpless when one morning the Gestapo came looking for the Jewish students whom the priests had offered sanctuary. In the notes to the film, Malle wrote, "That morning of 1944 changed my life. It may have triggered my becoming a filmmaker." I asked him to explain.
It has been such a traumatic event at the age of 11 for me, and they're suddenly exposed to violence and their intolerance and this brutality, the shock that it was for me to see those German soldiers enter our classroom and arrest one of the boys who happened to be my friend. I've been, as I was growing up, I've been trying to understand, and of course there's nothing to understand. It's just impossible. And I know my reaction in the following years was a reaction of anger. I couldn't understand. Of course, it was completely unacceptable. I started becoming very rebellious and very cautious about everything I heard from, the adults and teachers and my parents, and would try to convince me that was right or was true. And I wanted to find out for myself. And I think that really has triggered my urge to become a filmmaker. I thought making film was a way to try to find out about what was going on around, outside.
Well, it must have been really exciting to start making films in the 1950s during the period of the French New Wave, when all these really young, exciting directors like yourself were coming of age. And the French cinema was a very intellectual cinema, in addition to, loving the genre films of America. I mean, directors like you and Truffaut and Godard were intellectuals as well. It wasn't really a part of the American tradition of cinema.
There's obviously a contradiction, because in a way we admired, in Jean-Luc Godard's first feature, Breathless, there's a series of homages to the great American filmmakers. But he's completely an intellectual, and his style and approach to filmmaking is completely different. It's the opposite of Hollywood. So in a way, it was a paradox. But I think we've been really nourished by the American school, and we were intellectuals in the sense that we were the first generation where we decided that film was our medium. The generation before, they would have wanted to be novelists.
Or poets.
Or playwrights. But for us, cinema was the medium. And actually, through the 60s, it was. It was a very flourishing period for the French cinema. And we sort of took over. And for years, it was really exciting. And we were incredibly young. I made my first feature. I was 24 years old. So that was fun and exciting.
It really interests me that you got your start in filmmaking working with Jacques Cousteau, the famous underwater filmmaker and documentary filmmaker. Had you sought him out?
Well, I was in film school, and I was very lucky because one summer he asked the director of the school for an apprentice. And I think I was in the school the only one who could swim, so they picked me, and I really wanted to go. I was interested in documentaries. I was interested in Cousteau's work as a filmmaker, which is very interesting. And so I spent 2 months on the Calypso as an apprentice, And at the end of the summer, Cousteau told me that the man who was in charge of filmmaking with him, his assistant, was leaving because he was getting married. And do you want the job? I was not even 20 years old. I was in the middle of film school, and of course I said yes. How could I refuse? And I knew nothing, you know, but I worked very hard and I learned about editing, photography. I became an underwater cameraman, and we came up 3 years later with a feature documentary called The Silent World. And Cousteau has been incredibly nice and great class, because he offered me to be the co-director, which he didn't have to do. So I was co-director at the age of 23, of a film which won the Golden Palm at the Cannes Festival. The Oscar for feature documentary was an immense success. And so that was my start, and that was an incredible break for me.
Maybe I'm making too much of this, but getting your start in documentary films, did that teach you a certain emotional distance, teach you how to shoot something that was really exciting and compelling without really wringing every bit of emotion out of it?
Well, I don't know. The one thing that it did for me, I got so interested in this kind of direct cinema without a script, just filming something happening in front of you. I've always found fascinating, and throughout my career I've kept making personal documentaries, and this has always been a very important part of my work and very necessary for me to go back to the real world with a camera and so I think it has certainly had an influence on my fiction work too, but how to define it, I really don't know. What it probably has helped me to sort of define a style where I'm trying to get from the actors I'm directing the same kind of immediacy that I'm dealing with when I'm shooting documentaries.
You know, one of your feature films really walks the line between documentary and fiction film, and I'm thinking of My Dinner with Andre, which was basically a film about a long dinner conversation between Andre Gregory and Wallace Shawn. It's a wonderful movie, and it seems to me it's one of the most self-effacing movies on your part as a director, because it's a movie that really calls attention in a way to the actors and to the screenplay, and you think, well, this must have been easy to direct. It's just two people at a dinner table talking. But it must have been actually very, very difficult to direct a dinner table conversation and keep it as interesting as you did.
To keep it together, it was actually incredibly difficult. It's one of the, of my directing work that has given me more work. It's been really, because it's the whole point. It was when you said self-effacing, that's exactly what I was trying to do. I didn't want to certainly not to show off. I just wanted them to be as good as possible. I wanted the conversation to be as interesting as possible. I wanted the whole thing to work, which was a real challenge, because it seemed absurd to make a film like 2 hours about two characters discussing in a restaurant. So the whole point was at the end that it seemed like I've just been shooting them, and when actually we rehearsed for months. I work with them more than I ever worked with actors. I think I've directed Wally and Andre Gregory more than I've done ever. And I've done the same thing in a way with Au revoir les enfants, because it was a lot of work, but it's always what I'm trying to do. I hate to show off with the camera. I hate to demonstrate that I'm a good director. I hate to my work to be to be too present. One of the things I'm proud of with Au revoir les enfants, the last one, is that I think the spectator very, very soon forgets that there is a camera. And there's a lot of people have told me it's almost like a different experience that normally you have when you're watching a film. There's such an immediacy between the actors and what's going on the screen and your own emotions watching it, that it's almost there's nobody in between. Of course, in between there is, the work we've done, but it's meant not to show.
Well, as we mentioned before, Au revoir les enfants is your first French film in a decade. When you went back to France to make it, did you think a lot about how, if at all, your directing and filmmaking techniques had changed since you left France for America?
I don't think it has changed too much. I think what I've learned here is maybe a slightly different sense of rhythm. I suppose what I've done here is more like fine-tuning what I think is my style, which is to always privilege the actors over the camera, and to understand that filmmaking is a very collaborative art. And, you work with the crew, but mostly you work with the actors. That's what it's all about. And some of us, including myself, at the beginning of the new wave, we were on a sort of ego trip. We were the first one to claim that the director was everything.
Mm-hmm.
The script was not important. In a way, the actors were, like Hitchcock was saying, actors were objects. I've come back from that. 100%. I think now that I keep thinking and I keep telling my technicians, we're not on the screen. The actors are on the screen, and they're the one who carry the picture. We must help them. We must submit to everything that's going to make their work, which is very difficult, easier. And so that's what I've been trying to do all these years. But here, where the director is not as this sort of egomaniac they often are in Europe, that's maybe one of the things I've learned working here. And I think it's good in a way, because I'm very conscious of my privileges, and being the director, I'm the one who's supposed to make the final decisions. In the case of Au revoir les enfants, I wrote it, I directed it, I produced it. It's completely my work in a way. But the one thing I can say, I think if it works, it's because the people on the screen are great.
Director Louis Malle, he died of lymphoma last Thursday at the age of 63. Our interview was recorded in 1988. This is Fresh Air. A new essay collection titled Women on Ice sifts through the whole Tonya Harding-Nancy Kerrigan debacle from the 1994 Olympics. The feminist contributors to Women on Ice leave no triple Sal cow unscrutinized in their determination to read the Tonya-Nancy face-off as a microcosm of our culture's deeply conflicted attitudes toward female ambition, strength, and exhibitionism. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says she got the chills just thinking about Tonya and Nancy again.
At last, academic culture critics have found another woman, two in fact, to deconstruct besides Madonna. How refreshing it is to read essays on the semiotics of Tonya Harding's snapped shoelace and Nancy Kerrigan's frozen smile instead of yet another treatise on Madonna's projectile breast cones. To us lumpen couch potatoes, whose memories of the 1994 Olympics faded as soon as David Letterman's mom left Lillehammer, the amount of figure skating ephemera contained in Women on Ice is impressive. If your future as a Jeopardy finalist depended on it, could you recall the music Tonya skated to? The theme from Jurassic Park. How about the number of points by which Nancy lost to Oksana Bayul? 1/10. So close. No wonder Nancy acted snippy at the medal ceremony. First, to confirm a reader's worst fears about a scholarly project like this, there are indeed a few silly, theory-encrusted essays in Women on Ice, including one in which the Olympic competition is juxtaposed to the Bosnian War, and the fallen Tanya represents the fallen city of Sarajevo. One would need the interpretive acumen of a Dick Button to determine what exactly is being said here. But happily, most essays in this collection are as intellectually agile, impudent, and occasionally dazzling as one of Surya Bonaly's trademark backflips. And though the critical methods of these essays differ greatly, there's no dissension when it comes to deciding between the relative merits of tough cookie Tanya's athletic prowess versus Ice Princess Nancy's artistic ability. In the hands of these contributors, Nancy gets whacked once again. A clear standout in this collection is Judith Main's Fear of Falling, which regards the sport of women's figure skating as a public enactment of stereotypes of femininity. Main particularly focuses on the moment when these performances of femininity are disrupted, the moment of the fall. Main says, "So much of the experience of watching figure skating involves the anticipation of or reaction to the fall that one begins to suspect that part of the appeal of the sport for women viewers is the exhibition of femininity as a performance fraught with the dangers and possibilities of failure." Marjorie Garber's essay, Victor Petrenko's Mother-in-Law, is also a show-stealer. Genderbender scholar Garber discusses how female figure skaters are routinely depicted as part of a normative grouping of family, coaches, and friends. This is to reassure fans that the skaters' achievements are the product of a communal effort rather than an autonomous, unfeminine desire to win. Meanwhile, the personal backgrounds of male skaters suspected of being gay blades are covered up, just as their bodies are sheathed in their unitards. Other clever essays discuss the uncanny parallels between the Tanya-Nancy-Oksana rivalry and the Cinderella tale, and the dueling fantasies about the working class represented in Tanya and Nancy. There's also a nifty glossary of skating terms that'll be a must-have TV accessory for the next Olympics. Who could imagine that a bunch of academics on ice could disprove the dictum of that notorious pop culture scold, Karl Marx? All that's solid need not melt into air.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Women on Ice, Feminist Responses to the Tonya Harding-Nancy Kerrigan Spectacle, published by Routledge. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.